Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Try Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost, built for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, incredible load times, and 24/7 WordPress priority support, your sites will be lightning fast with global reach. And with Bluehost Cloud, your sites can handle surges in traffic no matter how big. Plus, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. Get started now at Bluehost.com.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the Great Crusade, toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you.
On the eve of this great adventure, I send my best wishes to every soldier in the Allied team.
The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
Our friends from the East cannot imagine what they are in for here. It's not a matter of fanatical hordes to be driven forward in masses against our line, with no regard for casualties and little recourse to tactical craft. Here we are facing an enemy who applies all his native intelligence to the use of his many technical resources. Dash and doggedness alone no longer make a soldier. And that, of course,
Grasshopper.
Is Field Marshal Erwin Rommel.
Of course it is.
Of course it is. And he's saying that to Fritz Bayerlein, his old chum from the Africa Corps days.
Right. And when's he saying that, Jim?
He's saying that in May 1944.
In the shadow of Overlord. So welcome,
the shadow
everyone.
Of Overlord.
Welcome, everybody, to
D-Day.
What is going to be, I think, our biggest We Have Ways series of episodes based around one subject, which is, of course, Operation Overlord.
Better known as...
D-Day. Although what's going to become clear, we hope, is that it's not just D-Day, because this thing is not just D-Day. There's so many other moving parts. The 24 hours is just one window in an enormous mansion with many windows, as it were. What the format of this is going to be, we're going to record episodes here in the podcasting style of the two of us get together and chatting, and then we will be doing episodes where we will be walking the ground in Normandy itself and having a good look, which we're going to do. We're going to do nearer the time. And of course, there's an awful lot that has to happen before it, and there's an awful lot that we have to put in the scales before we can put a single person on a single beach or
yes.
parachute or glider in anybody on either of the Allied flanks. And we thought what we'd do, as you could tell by Jim's immaculate impression and quote, that what we would do is start with the other side of the hill, or the other side of the English Channel, as it were, and have a good look at the state of play for the Germans, their expectations, the people that are in charge, what they've got in their inventory.
Or not, as the case may be,
which I think may be the way we're headed. And the thing to remember is if you're listening to this and you think, God, I need to get all of these episodes in one delicious chunk, then what you need to do is subscribe to either our Patreon and become a fully-fledged member of the Independent Company, where all sorts of stuff like live casts and bits and pieces, and there's some audiobooks up there, come your way, and news of things happen quickly and all that sort of stuff. Or you can subscribe to our Apple Podcasts channel. Everything's organized into subjects. One of the things we will be doing as these episodes progress is we'll say, oh, we've done an episode about that, haven't we? And you'll be able to literally go back to the Apple channel, find that episode, and fall down the rabbit hole that we are studiously going to try to avoid, trying to not rabbit hole too much on these episodes, because they are this is the Warren itself. So we don't need any other rabbits. But if you go to the Apple channel, because some of the things we're going to end up talking about, we've talked about before, sometimes in much, much greater depth or sort of in or more close up. So anyway, here we are. Welcome to our Overlord series. It's worth noting that by this point of the war in the rest of the world, regular listeners to the podcast will know that I think that if you're the rational German government of some people's imaginations, that 1943, the writing is plainly on the wall. But by the summer of 1944, I mean, the writing isn't just on the wall, it's on the table, it's covered on the chairs, it's on the floor, it's on the ceiling. The writing is absolutely everywhere.
It's staring you in the face and shouting down your ear holes.
Exactly. The British Army could hardly have been kicked out in greater ignominy from Europe in 1940. And yet, is preparing only 4 years later. And you think, you know, the pandemic for us was only 4 years ago. You know, not long ago, but also a long time ago, the way that time does that strange dilation thing. If the pandemic started really just before the beginning of 2020, you know, there's our phony war. By the spring, it was in full flow. Our Dunkirk, you know, if Dunkirk was basically 4 years ago from now, as we're recording and listening to this.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's actually, that's a really, really amazing perspective, isn't it?
That's the stretch of time we're talking about here. And that's the stretch of time in which the Allies turn that situation round. And it's also the stretch of time in which the Germans gradually lower themselves into the boiling cauldron of the Allied response. Because, you know, France falls June 21st, 1940. France then divided by the... So that it's interesting. You can look at it so that there's a Vichy government, or you can look at it that what the Germans have done is taken the Atlantic coast for themselves.
Which is basically what they've done.
It's that way round, really. You know, everything the Germans do is an expression of the power they seek to...
Yeah, why would they want to be bothering with the kind of day-to-day running of the interior of France, which is of no value to them whatsoever?
Precisely. You
know, leave that to someone else to do. Exactly. And that's all fine and dandy until November 1942, when Vichy North Africa is overrun by the Allies with Operation Torch, Northwest Africa invasion. They then occupy the whole of France. But it, you know, one has to remember that the Atlantic coast, and that includes Normandy, has been in German hands since June 1940.
Yeah.
You know, so it's 4 years.
It's 4 years. Let's just say, for the sake of argument, first couple of years, they're thinking, well, you know, we're safe, aren't we? We don't need to do anything. And these French postings are lush, charming postings away from the ghastliness of the Eastern Front, away from Italy. And by the time we're talking about, by the turn of the year into 1944, you know, they're getting hammered absolutely everywhere.
Eastern Front,
Italy. The Luftwaffe's getting destroyed in the skies over Germany itself.
Yes, and if anyone wants to, what we should say is we're not going to be doing too much on the pre-invasion air war, because we kind of feel we've covered that in episodes we've done on Big Week in the past, but also most recently our series on the Mighty Eighth. So if anyone wants to find out a little bit more about that, do go back to the Mighty Eighth series. But yes, it's every which way they look, they're being hemmed in, hammered. They're being hammered from the air. They're being hammered from the southern flank. From the eastern flank, and any minute now they're going to be hammered from. And I think it's fair to say that the Germans know the invasion is coming.
Every new stage of Allied sort of advancement, the Germans find themselves robbing Peter to pay Paul. So one of the dominoes of Sicily falling, or the invasion of Sicily, is that the Kursk offensive, Citadel, is called off. You know, that whatever happens, when the Allies pull a new lever, the Germans have to respond by denuding somewhere else in order to deal with it. You know, a thing we talked about in our series of Italy podcasts is that one of the functions of the Italian campaign, after all, is to draw people away to Italy from wherever, although ultimately from Normandy, so that you don't have to fight them in Normandy. And that, as a piece of strategy, is in full effect by the time the Germans are trying to seriously do something about defending their Atlantic coast. And I think it's very, very interesting this, though, because I think it's Frederick the Great who says, he who defends everything defends nothing. And it's very much the German approach is to try to defend everything in France, isn't it? And the problem with that is, again, if you look at it rationally, the invasion has to come under fighter cover. And that means the northeast French coast, really, doesn't it? Or the
Dutch coast, yeah.
Or the Belgian Dutch coast. Or the Belgian and Dutch coast.
But that's problematic because it's easy to flood and rest of it. Yeah. I mean, I can see where you're heading with this, which is surely they can narrow it down quite easily.
Well, I mean...
And you'd have thought so, yes.
Yeah.
But they don't. You know, there are 300,000 troops in Norway. I remember vividly going and visiting a Kriegsmarine coastal gun in the Arctic Circle north of Narvik.
Yeah.
You know, which is absolutely freaking enormous and can hurl a shell 32 miles out to sea or something ridiculous like that.
Yeah.
You know, that was made by Russian slave labor, captured POWs. The scale of production and construction along the Atlantic Wall, all the way from the Arctic Circle all the way down to the Spanish border in southern France, is absolutely enormous. You know, we're talking about 9,671 permanent concrete structures along the Atlantic Wall using 13 million cubic meters of concrete, 5% of Germany's total steel production, a value in today's money of $45 billion.
Surely you look at Norway and you think, well, that's quite a long way. It's quite a long way to Berlin from here. The Allies aren't going to come here.
Yes, and can someone please point out the beaches? because ports are easy to, you know, you cover them in explosives and you blow everything up. So, you know, and you cover the approaches and stuff. I mean, Norway is, from an invasion from sea point of view, unbelievably difficult.
Well, and, as the Allies have proven in 1940.
Right. So really, really hard. Then you've got the Dutch, you've got the Danish coast. Well, that's kind of full of sand dunes. That has got lots of long beaches, but you'd get sort of tied up in a narrow isthmus, which is, you know, peninsula, which is quite easy to defend from a German point of view. So you'd have thought that one would be out as well. And it's quite a big distance across the North Sea. Then you're getting down into kind of, you know, into the Dutch coast. Well, again, you know, it's very low lying from a German point of view, very easy to flood. You know, you break the dikes, blow up the dikes.
Tons of water obstacles.
Practically, that's not going to happen. Then you get to the Belgian coast, sort of ditto. Then you're starting to get to Flanders. Well, yes, absolutely. But it's closest to Britain. And that's where the Atlantic coast is most heavily defended. So, you know, it's worth continuing to defend that quite heavily, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah.
And leaving, you know, maybe a couple of sort of mobile divisions in that neck of the woods.
Yeah.
But the rest of the coastline, you know, but once you get to Normandy, that's too far because it's beyond kind of fighter range. You're not going to sort of, you know, the Channel Islands are in German hands anyway, so you haven't got, you know, the Allies haven't got that as a base. And anything further south than that just simply isn't going to happen.
Yeah, you're not going to invade the Bay of Biscay, are you, if you're the Allies?
No, you're just not, because it's too far. And the Germans have patterns of Allied assaults from which to kind of observe. I mean, so you look at somewhere like the Italian invasion that the Allies make, and you think, well, you know, from a German perspective, why are they invading at Salerno and not north of Naples or not even further north in Rome? Well, you know, it's pretty obvious. It doesn't take a huge amount of deep military understanding. And let's face it, you know, Germans have got some very deep military thinkers amongst their numbers. So it should be possible to work out that as long as you're preparing, you know, somewhere from, I don't know, southern Belgium to the Cotentin Peninsula, that's your baby. Yeah.
The Allies are in a continuum of amphibious landings, necessarily, because everything they're doing is expeditionary. Everything they do is expeditionary. It's not a land-based power in the way that Germany is. The German mindset is so continental in that respect. They're not thinking in these terms at all. When the Allies do something, even with their deep thinkers, and obviously one of the big problems is the man at the top, he makes his mind up, and then you have to second guess what his mind might be. And then he might change his mind anyway, which is the sort of going to Hitler and banging the table and saying, "My Führer, I know definitely that it's going to be Normandy." Is a thing you might do with your heart in your mouth. You know, that maybe he thinks that too, and as we're going to see. So anyway, so Rommel though is put in charge of the defence of France, isn't he? Although not
Army Group B. Well, not quite. Well, so he So he was in charge of Army Group B in Northern Italy. Then that gets sacked off because he gets trumped by Kesselring and that kind of power play. Army Group B gets shifted over to Northern France and Northwest Europe, because it also includes Belgium and Holland. He goes over in December to kind of be an inspector of the Atlantic Wall. You know, Hitler knows that he's kind of sort of upset Rommel a little bit, wants to sort of get him back in favour. So sends him off there to do something useful. And he's pretty horrified by it. You know, he thinks it looks pretty rubbish. In January, I think January the 15th it is, he's finally made, you know, he's formally appointed kind of Army Group B commander. Above him is the commander-in-chief of OB West, which is the overall kind of sort of Western theatre command, which is Field Marshal Gert von Rundstedt, who, of course, was Army Group A commander back in 1940 for Case Yellow when they invade France. He is pretty impotent by this point. You know, he's treading water. He's been sacked and reinstated a number of times. You know, he's kind of sort of knows that the war is over and is basically determined not to rock any boats. So you're not going to get any dynamism from him.
Yeah.
And then you've got the slightly odd situation that you've got General Lieutenant Leo Freiherr Gerd von Schreppenberg, who is commander of Panzer Group West, which is a sort of group of 10
divisions. If you could use
names
in Scrabble, you'd win with that, wouldn't you? I mean...
Yeah. But we'll get on to him in a little bit. I think, you know, sort of a bit of context on it, this is all important. But you know, his Rommel's command is... It looks quite strong on paper, but it's, you know, it's papering over cracks.
Jim, is this a product of, because I think people are familiar with the concept that what Hitler likes to do is promote people to kind of, so they'll fight like rats, you know, put people together so they fight like rats in a sack so they don't threaten him.
Yeah.
You know, that's the sort of the very much Hitler-driven way of dealing with your subordinates. Is that what this is, or is it just things being disorganized and
it's really disorganized, really. You'd be sort of in your arsenal of generals, you'd be stupid not to use Rommel, because Rommel's got experience of fighting against the Allies. I mean, you know.
That's the thing he has got. And actually, in a strange way, if North Africa is like the Petri dish where the Allies have figured out how to make things work, you know, because it's aside from aircraft, relatively small numbers of soldiers in, you know, 8th Army's not that big. You know, when 1st Army comes in, that again, that's sort of a brand new experimental formation in a way. And if you've been using North Africa as the Petri dish, then the person, you know, yes, he has experience of, I mean, this is the flip of it. Yes, he has experience of fighting the Allies, but the Allies have experience of fighting him and have defeated him. So, I mean, it makes sense in one regard if you're Hitler to give him that job, because he's the Allied expert. He's the bloke with experience in the Allies, but he's also the bloke that's been beaten all the way along the coast of North Africa and then thrown out of Tunisia. I mean,
yeah.
You know, it has its merits getting him in, but many of them for the Allies in a sense, don't they? You know, they know how to fight him. So what's he got though in terms of standards of troops?
Well, yes, and we should just we should talk a little bit about Rommel generally. Also just say that we've got episode 41, The Life and Death of the Desert Fox, and episode 657, The Life of Rommel, which I remember. So there you are. So you can find out a little bit more if you want to go back on those.
Brilliant.
But what he's got is let's just go to Normandy to start off with, because along the Normandy coastline, you've got 913 bunkers, permanent bunkers. And these are built by of course, by the organization TOT, which is the kind of sort of Reich labor organization. But also the Oberbauleitung Cherbourg, OBL, the chief construction directorate of Cherbourg, which employs 70,000 Frenchmen. I mean, can you imagine?
What, employing 70,000 Frenchmen?
I mean, it's quite... So that's where most of your labour is coming from. The big problem they've got is that as they're building this stuff more and more and more, I mean, it's fine in kind of 1943, but obviously anyone who's listened to our air episodes will know the transportation plan is in operation by kind of the spring of 1944, and this is to absolutely hammer railway links and bridges and all the rest of it. So what that means is a lot of your materials with which you would make concrete bunkers just can't get through.
Yeah.
And this includes the kind of sort of setting agents that you put into concrete and all that. So nearly all the...
And pouring the concrete is a very fine art. It all has to be timed quite perfectly. And we've talked about this as well, about the concrete on the Atlantic Wall, that if you get the timing wrong, then basically you ruin the piece of concrete, or if you end up having to pour it twice, then it has essentially a great big crack in it and all this sort of stuff. You know, the Labour's dragging its heels, perhaps, in some of this construction. So it's getting done slowly and it's not being done to the highest quality. And
well, it's very, very poor quality. I mean, you find basically that all the bunkers sort of up to kind of March 1944 are kind of sort of okay-ish, but post-March sort of April 1944, and, you know, bunkers are being made up right up to, new positions are being made right up to the eve of D-Day. They're very low grade because they're just made with kind of local materials and whatever they can make. So obviously that means they're kind of lower quality, which means they're kind of more likely to be smashed. But, you know, what's the alternative? Not making them at all. So, you know, they just go, what the heck, we've got to do what we've got to do with what we've got. But yeah, I mean, you know, Rommel, when he gets there in December, looks around and just thinks this is absolutely completely half-caught, particularly along this Normandy stretch. The northern coast of Normandy has got this lovely sort of swathe of open beaches. It just says sort of land lots of amphibious craft here.
Yes, it does rather say invade me.
Yeah. It does say invade me, and you know it's full of very you know, underdeveloped defences, and it's also developed, you know, manned by underdeveloped men, you know, manpower. Yeah. So most of the Normandy coast when Rommel turns up is commanded by the 716th Infantry Division, which is what we call a static division. It's a two regiment. It's a 1944 pattern, two regiments rather than three regiment division. And what that means is you'd have three battalions per regiment, so it's a bit like a British brigade.
Yeah.
And in a normal early war division, you'd have three regiments stroke brigades per infantry division. By 1944, you've only got two, which means they've got a standard manpower of sort of 12,000 rather than 16,000. And in reality, kind of less than that. So. And in March, arriving is the 352nd Division, Infantry Division. In a lot of the D-Day literature is referred to as elite, but it most certainly is not. I mean, not even remotely elite. It is a semi-mobile division rather than a static division, which means it's got some mobile means. It's got some mechanized transport, most of which are French trucks and bicycles.
Yep.
So it's, you know, horse and carts. And it's made up. So it's really.
It's got lots of people drafted from places that are suddenly German. So bits of Poland and bits of, and Alsace and places like that, where essentially if you've got a German surname, you end up in the here. It's the thing.
Yes.
Isn't it?
I mean, all these divisions, they're very much, that they're not German divisions. They are German army divisions.
Yeah.
Made up of men in German uniforms, which is not the same thing at all. So lots of Czechs, Russians, Poles, French, Mongolians, you name it.
Yeah.
They're all in them. Yeah. And, you know, it is absolutely, you know, whatever mechanization and weapons they've got, they're all sort of scraped together from whatever they can get their hands on.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in the case of the 352nd, usually referred to as elite, 75% of the officers and NCOs have got some combat experience, but only 10% of the rank and file have. And 30% are newly drafted conscripts from Alsace, Poland, you know, Ost battalions.
So the
you've got that comes with a whole host of problems, because it comes with language problems.
Yeah.
It comes with motivation problems. It comes with discipline problems.
Yeah.
You know, this is so far and away from, you know, the spearhead of 1940.
I'm going to have to ask, why are they often referred to as elite then in the literature? I think I know why.
I think a lot of it is because the story comes from you know, our understanding of D-Day comes from memoirs and people writing books about it, and you want to make yourself look as good as you possibly can, can't you? You're overcoming elite German figure, and they all have the same kind of automaton. You know, when you're looking at the kind of triumph of the will from 1935 or something, you know, the Nuremberg rallies, and there are all those rows of people in those helmets. The troops you're coming up against have still got the same helmets. They're still firing machine guns, whatever.
But it's also, rather than saying you cocked up, you say that we came up against elite soldiers who knew what they were doing.
But it's also just making yourself feel better about, you know, if you've overcome elite troops, then what does that say about you? You must be elite,
of course,
right?
And the flip of it is also, if things have gone wrong, well, of course, because you're up against elite people, it wasn't because you muffed it. It's because the opposition knew what, you know, I mean, it's.
But it's also particularly come across with Omaha Beach, hasn't it?
Yeah.
You know, which has been so mythologized and so kind of distorted in terms of what happens. And obviously, needless to say, we will come on to that.
We will get to that, yeah.
The 352nd are one of the better infantry divisions in France, in Normandy at the time.
And that's what they're like.
And they're pretty poor.
Yeah.
They're pretty poor.
Yeah.
They're commanded by General Lieutenant Dietrich Kreiss, who is pretty good.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're incredibly under-equipped. They don't have enough weapons. The weapons they have got have been kind of, you know,
cobbled together.
There's such a mixture of weapons.
Yeah.
It's absolutely astonishing. And then you've got the 716th Infantry Division, which is holding the entire kind of, you know, 60 miles of the coastline from Caen, the River Orne, which is the boundary between the 15th Army, which goes up from the River Orne in Normandy all the way up to kind of, you know, up to Belgium, Low Countries. And then you've got the 7th Army, which covers the rest of Normandy, and Brittany. And the 716th Infantry Division is the first one on the kind of eastern side of that border, you know, on the western side of the border with 15th Army. You know, I remember reading the accounts of Franz Gockel, who's in the 1st Battalion of the 726th Grenadier Regiment. And, you know, they're in the lineup for waiting for kind of, you know, their dish out of soup. And he's in the line and the ladle goes in and out comes a dead rat. You know, so it's really bad. I mean, you know, the supplies are bad, the food supplies are bad, they're underfed, they're under-equipped, they haven't got enough weapons, they haven't got enough ammunition. And although the 716th should be 12,000 strong, it's only about 8,000 strong. And they literally have no vehicles at all.
How Rommel intends to fight an invasion isn't with these people in particular, is it? This is the thing, is he's thinking, he knows the state of these... of this sort of crust, thinking, well, we're not going to be able to do it using these people, are we?
We've got to create a kind of force multiplier, which is our beach defences, mines, and so on. And we've got to try and resist initially, and then overwhelm
kick
the enemy
back.
With kick them back with back. Our 10 divisions, our mobile divisions, which are in a totally different league. And what we'll do is after break. We will come back and have a look at Rommel, what his plans are, and the hand he's been given.
See you in a tick.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk, your Second World War podcast. In episode one, part two, episode one of our D-Day and Overlord epic. I'm going to call it an epic because we haven't attempted a 12-part series before with four on the ground.
Yeah, let's face it, it's probably going to be 16.
Oh, Jesus Christ. apologies for the profundity there, everybody. So what we've summarised there is Rommel's inheritance on the French coast, particularly in Normandy, the state of play, how the Germans have got themselves into this situation, and what tools they're bringing to deal with an invasion that by the turn of the year into 1944, they know is coming. The strategic inevitability of an invasion of France, which I think everyone knows it's going to be France. And there's two possible places. Rommel's in charge. He's 52 by this point. It's worth bearing in mind that, you know, and we did cover this in the life of Rommel. Rommel's got where he has by being, you know, an entirely
tactically creative and
tactically creative, but also he's good at the politics. He's been good at playing the game with Hitler. He was part of Hitler's personal bodyguard after all. At one point, you know,
Lou Max winner from the First World War, of course. Don't forget that. You know,
exactly. So, and a man who regards himself as a sort of realist and a man of dash and an optimist too. I think one of the really interesting things about what he has planned, given what he knows about the Allies, that his big takeaway from the desert is, and we heard it at the start of this episode, is that, you know, the Allies are going to use guile, they're going to use cunning, they're going to use tactical resource. But the thing they're going to use more than anything else that is going to make things much more difficult for the Germans is air power. And he knows this. So I think it's quite interesting, as we're going to see, what his prescription is to sort this out, bearing in mind that he knows how difficult things will be with with air power. That there's a contradiction in that, in the conclusion he arrives at, I think. I mean, his headquarters is also in a, you know, he's quite a long way from anywhere. It's this, I mean, if...
Well,
if,
he's
if,
trying to be in the middle because his command is absolutely huge.
Gigantic.
I mean, it's really, really huge. So he's trying to find a kind of discreet headquarters. So he finds the Chateau of La Roche-Guyon, which is on the Seine. It's about 45 miles west of Paris, but it's on a bend in the River Seine, and it's kind of, you know, it's surrounded, it's cliffs are overlooking it and all the rest of it. It's quite a place. But, you know.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, you know, Chateau Generalship at its finest, this too, though, isn't it?
Wow,
I mean,
if yes, I suppose so. But
you know, if that's a criticism of the generals in the British generals in the First World War, here we can level it directly at German generals. He's no, I mean, yes, he's got an enormous command, but it's again that thing. It's if you defend everything, you defend nothing. So he spends all of his time toddling around in cars, and obviously not in an aircraft, moving around, because he'll get shot down. But toddling around in cars.
Well, yes, because I mean, let's face it. You know, Clark, for example, in Italy, is beetling around in his Piper Cub, and he can do that. So you know,
saving him all that time, so he can pop in.
I mean, he's like the Emperor Charles V. He's spending all his time traveling and not much time, you know, commanding. So you know, he's 160 miles from Calais, 100 miles from Caen, 180 miles from Rennes. I mean, you know, he's spending an awful lot of time in the back of his Merc
and turning up at places where the paint smells fresh. I expect that he's or it's the smell of drying concrete everywhere he goes. I mean,
yes, slightly sort of catches in the back of the throat a little bit. Just a tad.
And his chief of staff is Generalleutnant Hans Speidel, who is an Eastern Front guy and a military intellectual, really, isn't he? I mean, he's got a...
Yes, and they know each other from the First War. And actually, his Rommel's sort of old chief of staff, his absolute diehard chief of staff, a chap called Gauser. And Gauser gets sort of... basically offends Lucy Rommel.
Right.
Rommel's wife. And so gets given his marching orders, which is why Speidel comes in. He's sort of, you know, brown glasses, intellectual, as you say, PhD in political and military history, and a defeatist.
We have ways, listener.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, basically, Speidel was so alive, he'd love this.
Hi, Hans.
Good talk. No, your description is not something I recognize. You've got it all wrong.
But Rommel's conception is that what you do is fight them at the coast, and then deliver an armored counterpunch, and you have a mobile 10 mobile divisions, 9 panzer divisions, 1 panzer grenadier division, and that swings in and kicks the Allies back into the sea, which would buy Germany time. And of course, if this invasion were to fail, the Allies can't do it again for another year or something. Although actually, they've demonstrated in the Mediterranean that they can keep moving and rustle things up and try and knock the Germans off balance with different amphibious options. So although that the failure of the D-Day landings would be a major, it would be a political blow, perhaps, and a strategic one, but one that the Allies would feel the need to recover from, wouldn't they? Yeah.
Yes, so, absolutely.
So,
Rommel, he convinces himself that this is possible. It is possible to kick the Allies back into the sea. You know, if you hold them on the cross long enough until his 10 mobile divisions, we'll get onto those in a minute, can be brought to bear. And he will also be helped by 1,000 Luftwaffe fighter planes, which he's been promised.
This is the bit where you think,
What I don't understand is you know, he still believes this at the end of May, by which point the nearest Luftwaffe airfield is 500 miles away. So how are these 1,000 fighters going to come? And why doesn't he know this? You know, that's what I find absolutely amazing. And you see this time and time again in the Second World War, that there are flashes of intelligence brilliance on the part of the Germans.
Yeah.
But for the most part, they're operating blind. They don't join up the dots, and that's because of the nature, the structure, this divide and rule nature of the way Hitler runs his organizations and runs Wehrmacht.
Yeah.
That there is not much intelligence sharing. There isn't a pooling of resources in the way there is with the Allies, particularly, you know, the British in the run up to D-Day. You know, this idea that the kind of Y service, this sort of, you know, which is listening to radio traffic, is feeding into the code breaking of Bletchley, which is feeding into naval intelligence, which is feeding into air intelligence, which is feeding into army intelligence. It's all coming together into the joint intelligence committee, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. With kind of, you know, so you've got this sort of combination of you're gathering lots of, you know, and photo reconnaissance and all sorts of other stuff. Yeah. And, you know, you're pulling this all together to get a sort of complete picture. There isn't much joining up of dots. I mean, you know, why is it that German intelligence cannot guesstimate where the Allies are likely to land? Why is it that they're still thinking about Norway? Why is it that they're still thinking about southern France and the Bay of Biscay? You know, why is it that Rommel is not putting a massive question mark over 1,000 fighter planes that have been promised actually arriving in reality?
Yeah.
There's this big kind of sort of fug of kind of sort of,
well,
and this bad thinking. It's just makes no sense at all.
But do you think that the 1,000 fighters is the thing? He's gone to see Hitler. Hitler shook him by the hand, looked him firmly in the eye, and told him, "Don't worry." And he's hypnotized by him still. That it's that thing of
I think that's exactly what's happening. But it is remarkable for someone who is so obviously is as bright as Rommel is, and with his vast experience, that he's not going, you know, I've been promised these 1,000 Luftwaffe. Hang on a minute, you know, let me just chaps, you know, on my staff here at Army Group B, can you just give me a kind of update? You know, what's the situation with the Luftwaffe? Yeah. You know, can you put a call into me? And find out where they all are, and you know, where is the nearest airfield, and you know, do a bit of checks yourself, because he knows enough about Hitler by this point to know that Hitler's promises are not always kind of
what's best informed
or indeed maintained.
Rommel's motive, though, he is to keep Bolshevism out. After all, that's the other thing. He's also
I mean, you know, there's a great quote which he explains what is. Do you want to do it this time?
Yeah, I have to be satisfied with what little I've got and try and defeat the enemy with only the most modest means. And defeated they must be if Bolshevism is not to triumph over us. Even then, when we have defeated Britain and the United States, the war with Russia won't be over because she has enormous resources of men and raw materials. Perhaps then a united Europe will come forward to fight this enemy. I mean, that's mental. That's bonkers. It's mental. Once we've defeated Britain and the United States. I mean, what?
But I think at this point,
it just sounds like party line, that, rather than anything
It does
else.
Sound like party line, but I think what Rommel is trying to do is he's trying to make sense of this terrible situation that they find themselves in, where they're clearly losing the war, and he's trying to justify continuing to fight. He's trying to, you know, but because you know, spoiler alert, it doesn't go very well for Rommel in Normandy, and very quickly he goes from kind of, we can do this, to.
Game's up.
We're stuffed, which is, you know, and it's like he's got two kind of thoughts on his shoulder, and one's trying to kind of sort of push the other. And just in this run-up, you know, he's re-energized by the prospects of kind of the fight and, you know, perhaps
command.
They can win after all, and command and, you know, the responsibility and all the rest of it. So he's trying to put as good a spin on it as he possibly can. But in his dark moments, when he wakes up at kind of 3 a.m. and stares up at the ceiling and La Roche-Guyon, he must be having major doubts. And you sort of sense that in his frustration with the defences, because he spends an awful lot of time going around with General Lieutenant Wilhelm Meiser, who is his chief engineering officer. And, you know, they're because they know that their troops are rubbish, static troops are rubbish and under-equipped, more and more emphasis is put on these belts of offshore defences. You know, and what we're talking about here is the Belgian gates that, you know, so they have like a sort of like a metal frame which is stuck on the beach, covered in explosives. Then you have Rommel's asparagus, which are these sort of telegraph poles or tree poles, you know, tree trunks put onto a kind of gliders. But stock gliders, but also stop ships, and they've got kind of explosives on the end. You know, as he goes around and sees these incredibly unimpressive troops and sees them sort of labouring over building, pouring in yet more kind of low-grade concrete, he thinks, okay, I can't expect too much from them, but we've got to hold them. We've got to hold them until the mobile divisions can counterattack. The only way we're going to do this is ever more numbers of mines. You know, they've gone from kind of 2 million mines in October 1943 to 6.5 million by kind of, you know, I don't know what it is, sort of May 1944 or whatever, but he wants 20 million and then he wants 200 million and, you know, and he wants ever more non-human defences because he knows his human defences aren't going to be up to it.
aren't, or don't exist. I mean, there aren't the numbers. Okay, so the 10 mobile divisions, and I think people who've read about D-Day know that there is this panzer deployment debate within German command as to what you do with your panzers. Debate creates the illusion that this is all being conducted in a kind of gentlemanly way, and the House maintains that what we should do is deploy our panzers here. German generals fighting like rats in a sack, Hitler in the mix, people desperate for attention, for power, for command, for being the bloke who wins the war, and all this, you know, how chaotic the German command is by this point, I think is, and you know, is also why there are still people in Norway trying to defend Norway from an invasion that isn't coming. The chaos of it all. Debate is too polite a word to sort of encapsulate what we have here. But basically, it's what do you do? You know, Rundstedt wants to hedge his bets generally because he's kind of played out. Yeah. And it probably feels no one listens to me anyway. So what's the point of me offering an opinion? Hitler, by this point, his decision making is completely crazy paving, isn't it? You just don't know which way he's going to jump, right? No. If you're going to him, or if you're asking for his opinion, or if you're asking for his approval, if you're asking for his backup or his say so, you just don't know, do you? And that's what's going on.
So there are these. So you've got all these. You know, I think there's something like 15 infantry divisions in the 7th Army, which is covering Normandy, most of Normandy and Brittany. Yeah. I think there's 19 divisions in 15th Army, you know, Salmet's 15th Army, which, you know, runs up from the River Orne up through Le Havre, Dieppe, Calais, etc. And they're these, you know, they're very much these static divisions with a few kind of vaguely mobile divisions like the 352nd.
Yeah.
But they're very much the kind of sort of dregs. And you know, I've mentioned this before, but if you sort of think of a sort of, you know, a line, a sort of horizontal line as being a sort of, you know, a not bad quality division.
Yeah.
The Allied line seems to sort of wiggles up and down sort of either side of that mean line, but not very dramatically. Whereas in the German army, in the Wehrmacht, what you get is you get these sort of absolute leaps. You get sort of really very good divisions to kind of absolutely rubbish. And Rommel is hoping that the static divisions combined with vast numbers, millions of mines and beach obstacles will be able to hold the Allies just long enough until he can mass these 10 mobile divisions. The 10 mobile divisions are 9 panzer divisions where your absolute fighting thrust is, you know, these are all, incidentally, all arms units and one panzer grenadier division. So 10 mobile units. They're all fully mechanized. They're a combination of motorized infantry, motorized reconnaissance, anti-aircraft, anti-tank, artillery, all motorized, and of course tanks as well. And the difference between a panzer grenadier and a panzer is that there are more assault guns, tracked vehicles with a gun on, an artillery piece on, than tanks, which are you know, anti-tank guns on a rotating turret in a panzer grenadier than there are on a panzer division. But these are the best equipped, best trained, for the most part, all German.
Yeah,
Much better motivated. They are much larger. So, you know, something like the 12th SS Hitlerjugend Division, for example, is about 22,000 strong. Yeah. The Panzer Lehr is about 17,000, something like that.
Yeah.
So they're much bigger than your kind of, you know, 12,002 regiment, 1944 model cruddy infantry. Now, the obvious thing is for these mobile groups to come under Rommel's command because he is the commander of Army Group B. But they don't. They come under General Leo Freiherr Gerd von Schreppenberg, who is commander of the Panzer Group West. And he gets made this appointment shortly after Rommel is made Army Group B commander back in January. Yeah. And Gerd is very cultured. He's an ex-military attaché in London. He speaks English flawlessly. He's a protégé of Guderian, the great, you know, panzer leader.
Panzer general.
The great breakthrough man across the River Meuse back in May 1940, etc. But he's an Eastern Front man. He's never fought in the West at all, and he doesn't understand Allied air power, and he believes that you should hedge your bets and believes that the panzer divisions can be held further back and still brought to bear quickly. And this is the source of the argument. What Rommel is saying is, no, you can't. You will not be able to move up. The only way you'll be able to move quickly is if you're close to the coast. And so
yeah.
therefore we need to hedge our bets and have these 10 divisions all in a kind of arc around either side of the River Seine. So we need some in Normandy, we need some north of Normandy so that we can strike. And we're just going to have to take a punt on where we think the most likely place is going to be. And I think the most likely place to be is probably north of the River Seine in Normandy, but it might be south of the River Seine. But I think it's that neck of the woods.
Yeah.
And Gerd just says, I think that's too risky. You just can't, I just don't believe that. I think we can, you know, we've got the best mechanization. We'll just get them there to wherever the answer, and then we can kind of, you know, we can respond to however it plays out. And this is an argument that just doesn't get sorted out. Yeah. And on the 19th of March, Rommel goes to the Burghof, which is Hitler's favourite home down in the mountains near Berchtesgaden, kind of stone's throw from Salzburg in the Bavarian Alps. And he has a one-on-one with Hitler. And Rommel's very persuasive. Hitler tells Rommel that he thinks Normandy and Brittany are the most likely place. It's not going to be Brittany. I don't know why he'd think that. And the next, very next day, he tells Rommel that he will most likely give him control of all the panzers.
Oh, God.
But he doesn't formally say it.
He doesn't do
so
it.
So Rommel goes back rubbing his hands, thinking, great, that's in the bag. Yeah. But nothing happens and nothing happens and nothing happens. Yeah. And on the 23rd of April, Rommel is still trying to get formal authorization to have complete control of the Panzer Group.
And he's lobbying everyone he possibly can.
He's lobbying everyone. So he lobbies Jodl, who is the chief of the operations staff at OKW. So he's like you're kind of the number one pen pusher within the OKW, which is the combined general staff. And he says, provided we succeed in bringing our mechanized divisions into action in the very first hours, then I'm convinced that the enemy assault on our coast will be defeated on the very first day.
Isn't so much of this, because after all, when we looked at Italy, you know, Rommel offers a solution if he's in charge of the solution. This does sound quite a lot like, please give me the toys to play with, rather than actually any of this is sensible.
Yes, but he is still right, and he is providing the best chance of.
I guess, but there is also an argument that what you don't do is get entangled on the beach within the range of fighters, and you build a firm line. You know what you don't do is feed yourself into the Allied.
So you take the Japanese approach to Okinawa, which is to kind of not contend the beaches and let them come in, and then have them almighty ding dong.
Exactly. Von Schwepperberg, maybe he's come from the Eastern Front, but maybe his understanding is, I don't want particularly to sit under those, you know, 14-inch guns much, thank you.
Yes, but that also precludes the fact that Hitler is going to let you retreat to an advantageous ridgeline and all the rest of it, you know.
Well, of course. Of course. And here's the problem is that there isn't a strategy. There isn't – no one's actually figured out.
No. So eventually Rommel just orders 2nd Panzer Division to Abbeville over and above von Schreppenberg's head. Von Schreppenberg's a bit kind of miffed about this because he thinks, you know, these are my divisions. They're not up to you to start ordering them around. Yeah. So Gehr and Gehr von Schreppenberg and Guderian arrive at La Roche-Guyon on the 28th of April. And they actually have a very sort of convivial dinner in the lovely chateau. But there is still this impasse and Rommel is still lobbying. And then on the 8th of May, Hitler makes his judgment, which has got to be one of the very worst he makes. Because it's a kind of, you know, it's a something and nothing. And what he decides is that Rommel is to have tactical command of 2nd Panzer, 116th Panzer, and 21st Panzer, which is the only Panzer division which is actually based in Normandy. Whereas Gehr is to have operational and tactical command of 1st Panzer, 12th SS Panzer of the 1st SS Panzer Corps, and the Panzer Lehr, and the 17th SS Panzer Grenadier. And those four are very much the elite, creme de la creme, it has to be said. But that means instead of having 10, Gehr has got direct control over 4. And then, check this, Hitler decides that what he's going to do instead is set up a new army group G in the south of France with 2nd SS Panzer, this is Das Reich, 9th Panzer and 11th Panzer.
I mean, this really
That is absolutely insane.
I mean, this smells of anything, you know, like a sort of... you know, deferral exercise, anything than to actually have to make the decision you need to make. It's like, I'm making decisions here. What's wrong with you people? But it's not the decision that actually needs to be made. Do you know what I mean? You kind of think this is a month, D-Day's a month off. They don't know that obviously, but they got a pretty good idea. It's coming this summer. D-Day was originally scheduled for May, wasn't it? Overlord was meant to start in May. I mean, imagine if they're still having this argument as the invasion you know, occurs.
It's absolutely extraordinary. But also, you know, but Rommel doesn't give up on that. You know, he's still continuing to lobby and still saying, you know, give them all to me, give them all to me. I mean, it's interesting looking, you know, what you see in Normandy is this sort of, you know, it's a kind of absolute reflection of the state of the Wehrmacht at this point, and particularly the German army, which includes, you know, and I'm including the Waffen SS units at this point as well. You know, so 15th Army, you've got General Oberst Hans Salmert, who is pretty competent, but he's got blood on his hands because he's, you know, his forces have had Einsatzgruppen and subordinated to them in the Eastern Front. Yeah, yeah. He's sacked for defying orders and with his Second Army and breaking out of Stalingrad. Hitler then reinstates him, gives him 15th Army. By this point, he absolutely loaves Hitler. He's a bit like von Rundstedt, you know, he can't really be asked, you know, just wants to sort of sit it out and kind of not rock the boat too much. So Rommel thinks he's a bit lazy. Then 17th Army, you've got 14 divisions, and this is General Oberst, so Colonel General Friedrich Dolman. Dolman is just an absolute total waste of space. You know, he's fat, kind of idle, has been in command of 7th Army in Normandy since the summer of 1940, done absolutely nothing, hasn't kept up with the times whatsoever. You know, he's like the guy who's kind of doesn't understand what an iPhone is or has never heard of TikTok or, you know, just absolutely hopeless. But on the other hand, the kind of the main core, which is covering this part of Normandy, is 84 Corps. And this is commanded by General Lieutenant Erich Marx, who is, you know, thin-faced, bespectacled, intellectual, competent, very, very experienced, has lost a leg in Barbarossa. And Rommel has wanted him as the 7th Army commander, but he's been denied because Dolman's a good Nazi and Marx is a dangerous intellectual. You know, he's sort of slightly known to have been losing his less enamored with the luster of National Socialism. You know, he needs to go on an indoctrination course. You know, it's not a great situation. And, you know, Rommel is spending his time just sort of beetling up and down the coast, you know, all the way up to the Pas-de-Calais and back and round and, you know, and all the rest of it. You know, as we were saying, you know, both him and Mieser now want, you know, instead of 6.5 million mines, which they've got, they want 20 million. And then they want, you know, even more than that. And the troops are horribly under-equipped. And the
more and bigger guns and all this.
They've got, you know, they've got 380 millimeter guns rather in Cherbourg, for example, but they haven't yet been put in casements. They just haven't got around to it. There's only 130 guns of 100 millimeter caliber or more along the entire Normandy coast. You know, 130 is not very many. I mean, when you think that opposite Omaha Beach alone, there's more than 184 guns brought to bear by the Allied navies on D-Day.
This is an effect of trying to defend everything, though, isn't it?
Yes, it's worth reminding that, you know, there's 15,000 anti-aircraft guns in Germany alone, 130 on the Normandy coast.
We've got to be quite careful here because we're making this sound like it might be easy. You know, whereas I think we've seen again and again and again and again and again and again. If you've listened to our Italy series, recent Italy series, defending if you've got strong points that work for you, and there are strong points along the Normandy coast, these Widerstandsnester. If you've got strong points and if you've got people who are mobilized properly, you can defend. If you create little fortresses, little festungs in villages or whatever, in the right places, you can defend and you can hold up. And you've got to be, we you know.
And this is what Rommel's
saying. If you only listened to this episode, you might think, well, you know, what's all the fuss about D-Day?
It was a piece of cake.
Piece of cake. Of course it was. The Germans, you know, the Germans are chronically disorganized and, you know.
When the Allies are attacking Sicily, there's hardly any coastal defenses at all. I mean, a few bunkers and that's it. A bit of wire, whatever. When they attack in Salerno, it's the same. It's the same thing. You know, there's actually no anti-invasion obstacles on the beach at all in Salerno.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that is a lesson that the Germans have taken from Salerno. Yeah. They haven't might not have learned the lessons about air power, but they have learned lessons of that. You know, there are only two belts of offshore obstacles, not four belts, which is what Rommel wants. You know, and he goes up to on the 30th of May, he visits the Breville Ridge, which is where British airborne troops will be for much of the Normandy campaign. And he looks down on there and he goes, that's a really obvious place for a landing zone. You know, get some more asparagus on there.
Get some stuff in there,
Quickly, but that's the 30th of May. So, you know, and some of these strong points are really, really strong. And it's worth mentioning WN. So WN stands for Widerstandsnester, 17 and 16, which is created by Oberst Ludwig Krug. So Colonel Ludwig Krug, who is an engineer, and he is the commander of Infantry Regiment 736 of the 716th Division. And, you know, he's brought all his engineering skills to bear in perfectly sighting these two strong points, one on the ridgeline, one lower down, one with guns, one with more with kind of, you know, observation. And from there, they can see over to the River Orne, you know, and they can see the Breville Ridge. They've got Conn behind them. They're basically blocking Conn. You can look across to this very small city of Douvres. You can look at the Finkelstein radar station. You can absolutely see the coastline. You know, this is what's going to be called Sword Beach. And this is probably, certainly, the strongest single strong point or series of strong points on the entire Normandy coastline. So, and it's made with good quality concrete and all that kind of stuff, you know, in sharp contrast with some of the other parts of the Normandy coastline, you know, like, you know, along what becomes known as the Utah Beach, very, very underdeveloped, hasn't been really barely done at all. So it just depends. But it's interesting, you know, when you're looking at the troops, they're not all awful, of course. There's Fallschirmjäger Regiment 6, for example, which is made from a cadre of 1st Fallschirmjäger Division NCOs and officers. You know, this is where Martin Purple is attached, who's a Crete veteran, a Eastern Front veteran, a Sicily veteran, a Southern Italy veteran, you know, for example.
So he knows what he's doing, if nothing else. And he's mobilized. These are motivated people, the Fallschirmjäger, aren't they, in a way?
They're motivated. They're all German.
Yeah.
They're all disciplined. They've got greater motivation. They're not going to throw in. They're under-equipped as well in terms of heavy weapons, but they've got more machine guns than any, you know. So per 10 men, you've got 2 machine guns rather than 1. They've got assault rifles, blah, blah, blah. Commanded by Oberst Friedrich Freiherr von der Heyter. And they're pretty good. But again, you know, von der Heyter is not impressed by what he sees in Normandy. He goes, weapons from all over the world and all periods of the 20th century seem to have been accumulated in order to convey the impression of a mighty force. And General Marx, our bespectacled, one-legged, competent general, says, you know, emplacements without guns, ammunition depots without ammunition, minefields without mines, and a large number of men in uniform with hardly a soldier among them. I mean, it's pretty damning, isn't it?
And of course, what he's also doing is asking for more. You don't say that if you don't want more.
Yeah, but you don't. You'll never see the Allies. You know, even the Allies are sort of, when they're complaining about kind of, you know, Shermans versus Tigers, you're not getting this kind of scale of language.
What
this is implying is that people who know what they're talking about are knowing that Normandy might be the land of plenty in terms of butter and Calvados and cedra, but it's not in terms of weapons and ammunition.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember following a chap called Leutnant Hans Heinzer, who was an experienced commander from the Eastern Front. He'd been wounded, came back and was plonked into the 325th Division. Sorry, the 352nd Division.
Yeah.
And, you know, he said a large percentage of the machine guns in the bunkers were captured weapons that did not fit our standard ammunition. At several points, the barbed wire and trenches were not complete or manned properly.
Yeah.
And on the 4th of June, Heinzer is accompanying an 84 Corps staff officer on an inspection tour. And he says to him, Herr Mayor, we have enough ammunition to stop the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and maybe even 5th wave of Tommies. But after that, they're going to kick the door in on top of us. And then all is lost.
And that's Sunday, the 4th of June.
That's Sunday, the 4th of June. But I think it's worth just, you know, finishing on this episode with Rommel's tour that he does of the Normandy coastline on the 30th of May. This is the day that he's on the Breville Ridge and sees what he thinks could be a landing zone. And he visits the 21st Panzer Division, the only one of these 10 mobile divisions that is operating in Normandy.
Which, again, is a mishmash, isn't it?
It's a total mishmash.
Pieced together, piecemeal thing, isn't it?
Yeah. So 21st Panzer is not in the same league as Panzer Lehr, 12th SS, 2nd SS, etc.
Yeah.
And he sees Major Hans von Luck, who is his old reconnaissance battalion commander from 7th Panzer Division days back in 1940, and served with him in the Deutsche Afrika Corps in North Africa as well.
Yeah.
And Hans von Luck is now commanding officer of the Panzer Grenadier Regiment 125. They pause and chat, and he says, good to see you again, von Luck, etc. But 21st Panzer is, while the other regiment, Panzer Grenadier Regiment 22, is commanded by Oberstleutnant Hermann Oppelm Bronikowski, who again is sort of former Olympic gold medal winning equestrian. He's a Knight's Cross winner from Russia. You know, he's super, super competent. You know, very much in the kind of sort of high end of German commanders that we kind of, you know, that's how we imagine them all to be. But the commander of the division is General Major Edgar Feutinger, who is just another, like Dolman, sort of fat Nazi who's kind of constantly going off to Paris to shag his mistress and, you know, has no experience of commanding armored units whatsoever. He's completely hopeless. And the priority for Hitler by at this point is making sure that he's got enough good Nazis sprinkled amongst the higher echelons rather than competent commanders.
That's what he's interested in. That's the thing. The politics is more important to him, to have that ticking over. Yes. As it always has been, is the truth. That's always been the thing he's interested in.
And as Rommel visits, Allied aircraft kind of sort of hurtle over. And he says to the assembled crowd, which includes von Luck, says, "Gentlemen, I know the English from Africa and Italy, and I tell you, they will choose a landing site where they think we do not expect them to land. That will be right here on this spot."
Fantastic.
But he also predicts that the invasion is not going to take place for another 3 weeks.
Yeah, but there's another Mystic Marks, General Marks.
A
different view. From my knowledge of the English, they will go to church again next Sunday and then come on Monday. And that would be Monday, the 5th of June.
So 1944.
He's on the money.
He's on the money. He's more on the money than Rommel, isn't he?
Yeah, Marx knows.
Marx on the money.
That's the German state of play on the
eve of Overlord.
D-Day. Episode one. Of maybe the rest of this year's We Have Ways.
The longest day in history. Et cetera, et cetera. Got to stop doing this. It's just irresistible.
Yeah, it is irresistible, but it also must be resisted. Thank you very, very much for listening. Episode two, we will be
looking at the British plan, the Allied plan.
The British plan, the Allied plan. And it's worth remembering, really, that, you know, it's the Royal Navy. It's the British that make this possible. Just want to put that out there for our American listeners. Thanks very much for listening. We will see you all again very soon. Tschüssi, tschüss.
Tschüssi, tschüss. Cheerio.